stand up straight at the foot of your love. I lift my shirt up. Stand up straight at the foot of your love.
Okay, so I'm here with Holly Tucker, who was most recently the author of Bloodwork. Holly, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
I wanted to first of all start with a very basic question. It seems logical to ask. I know bloodletting, and I know bleeding, not personally, but I do understand that its historical basis was based off of trying to release the ill humors
Absolutely.
Out of blood and all mm-hmm. that. The big question I think that we should start off with, so that people know what we're talking about, is how did such a primitive approach to blood become something that, you know, why did people start thinking, oh, well, hey, we can probably use this for transfusion purposes. We can probably use this for transferring one blood to another. I mean, it seems in light of its early use before the 17th century that there was nothing in the cards to suggest that human beings would come up with something like this.
No, so. In fact, the fact that they did in the 17th century is in itself a story we're telling, because yeah. for millennia, they believed that the body was just this mix of fluids, as you said, humors, blood, phlegm, bile, black bile. Ill health was when those fluids were out of balance, and good health is when they were in balance. So they, you know, we laugh now about bloodletting because we think it's the most gruesome and horrific thing, and it was.
Yeah.
But it made total sense to them
yeah.
that they would need to, well, that and purging and laxatives, right? So what you tried to do is to rid the body in any way you could of all these foul humors. So you're gonna ask me about how did they get to blood transfusion, and
yes.
so I'm trying to make my answers sort of nice and compact for you.
Oh,
so because
I
what
see.
Will happen is I will go for the next 10 minutes.
We'll go for a protracted answer. Well, protracted answers, by the way, are welcome here.
So when you start dozing off, you tell me.
Oh no,
then,
okay, no, no,
and then
there
jump
won't be any
in with
dozing
questions.
Here. I assure you, I'm fascinated by this subject. We're talking about blood. We're talking about gore.
Gore.
We're talking
mm-hmm.
about viscera. Okay. Mm-hmm. You note that some of the natural philosophers who were so duped by their own success they couldn't actually judge the results.
Mm-hmm.
Objectively, Edmund King reported that a sheep he had infused with milk and sugar was more than ordinarily sweet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, just talking about the Royal Society, we'll get to the French later, what were some of the chief factors that made the Royal Society carry on with these things without this scientific oversight that we now know in the 20th and the 21st century? Can we really call these early efforts science if there was, well, first of all, they lacked the vigorous oversight, but second of all, the unmitigated torture of animals, which we can also get into.
Well, you know what, though? I would say that what they were doing was science, and they believed that what they were doing was science. In fact, early blood transfusion happened because of one of the biggest and most important scientific discoveries in medicine, which was the discovery of blood circulation,
yeah.
right? And William Harvey was very methodical about how he went about discovering blood circulation in 1628. So he was really confused by this idea of humors, and he shouldn't have been, because it had been the dominant way of viewing the body for millennia, as I said. He said there has to be a better explanation, or at least there has to be a good scientific explanation about how these humors work. And he was suspect about the whole idea that blood was produced in the stomach and then was distilled into the liver and then moved up to the heart, where it was burned off like a furnace, and that breathing was a way to stoke the fire and then also blow off the fumes. And that's what they believed up until Harvey. So he started to do some detailed methodical experiments by first dissections, animal and human, looking at how much blood was in the heart. And then he noticed in a human heart that there was about 2 ounces of blood in the human heart, multiplied that by the number of heartbeats, and found this obscene number, like 41 pounds of blood would have to be produced in a half hour. So he said, this cannot be. And so then he started doing experiments on live animals, particularly cold-blooded animals, and he said, aha, no. Blood is circulating. So, you know, for as much as we look back, and yeah, there's a lot to laugh about in previous periods, and a lot of it is
gross.
A lot to laugh
about. Torturing animals, just
okay.
a barrel of laughs.
As far as a lot to laugh about, as far as how they understood the body
yeah.
and the way the worldview dictated the questions they could ask, the answers they would then get, because it's a completely different philosophical, economic, political framework than we have now. Yeah, torturing animals is not a cool thing. It never has been. It never will be. But there, too, you can start to see what's happening is it came from a notion of the body and the mind and the soul being distinct. And that's an idea that's coming out in the 17th century in the works of, for example, René Descartes. Quiz. Who's René Descartes?
He's some guy who was all about thinking, maybe therefore something along those lines.
And maybe I think therefore I am. Yeah, that's. We associate him with the scientific method, right? My daughter is in grade school, and she just did one of her first science fair projects, and came home and did the poster, and it was almost like watching Cartesian indoctrination. In her science, because he put that idea forth, but he also put that idea forth. Along with another one, which was mind-body dualism, is he said, what differentiates animals from humans? We all have, both animals and humans have bodies, and those bodies are very likely very similar. Maybe they're machines. And this is the age of hydraulics. Hydraulics is a science that's being invented, barometers, you name it. So it makes sense that they're viewing the body as a machine. And he says, well, the thing that, if we're both machines and body, there has to be something that is different, is that maybe we, well, we have minds, we think, we speak, we have souls. And those souls and the capacity for thought can't be in the body.
Yeah.
Because animals, he said, don't have that.
Yeah.
And so that, if we take the soul out of an animal, then, and they become nothing more than machines, then it's a bit like working on your car.
Yeah.
Are you really torturing that animal? Now, I'm not saying I think that, but that's what Descartes. Allowed the natural philosophers, as scientists were called, to be able to do, is to start taking apart those machines, those animals.
We'll get more specifically into animal torture just a bit, but I did want to actually jump
That's
off.
That's a nice way of a segue. We'll talk about animal torture soon.
But let's talk about the method in which the Descartesian notion of I think, therefore I am, especially in relation to animals, led to what you talked about earlier, which was the theory of circulation. You point out, quite interestingly, that Sir Christopher Wren, the Great Fire of London, he had a city plan to rebuild London entirely from the ground up, and it was designed very much the way the body is, thick arteries, very much along those lines. So there's this connection between the body, medicine, and architecture that is going on around 1666. What's interesting, too, in your book is that you also point to Claude Perrault later in the book.
Which nobody will know who that is.
Yes. Well, here was a guy, he shunned associations between blood and architecture, and he was a big wig in the French medical community. But I'm wondering if you're suggesting that Perrault was a little more flexible, if he had been a little bit more flexible with his assumption or his association, that perhaps you wouldn't have so many wild men cutting up dogs later on, or that the process of a really vigorous scientific method that, of course, we now enjoy, and that came after all of this experiments, that would have actually come about. I'm curious how the theory of circulation led to, was it really that important? The theory of circulation, specifically in connection to that connection between architecture and medicine.
Okay, so the first thing is the connection between the body and architecture, and that's a long-standing connection.
Oh, feel free.
Is that, you know, think about, I am totally blanking on the guy who did the Vitruvian Man. Please give me his name. Wow. Da Vinci.
Yeah, of course.
You see that, like, image, right? The Vitruvian guy standing there naked with his arms outspread, and what he's doing, the reason why it's called Vitruvian Man is because it goes back to Vitruvius from antiquity, and Da Vinci is specifically looking at the body in terms of ratios, angles, and geometry, right? So the whole idea that the body is connected up to architecture has a long process. Now, what's interesting, though, is that's normally been something really static and stable, right? So you have column Greco-Roman buildings, looking at angled classical architecture. You're making me think that I didn't make this connection in the book, but is it really the body, i.e. anatomy in architecture, or is it really we're seeing a move to physiology in architecture? And I think that's where the heart now becomes the central, it used to be the stomach that was the central area, along with the heart, for blood use and whatever, but the heart now becomes the main center of the human body. And that also has political ramifications, right? Because in that Christopher Wren drawing in the that you saw in the book, is that there still is a head.
Yes.
Right? What is that head? What is that heart, that center going to be? Is it going to be the monarchy? Is it going to be the exchange where trade is done? And even the street drawings that Wren, who is, of course, famous, the most famous architect of London after
yes.
the rebuilding of the city after the Great Fire.
And later to go on to do St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yeah, you can't talk about Wren without talking about St. Paul's. And one thing that most people don't know is that he spent his time as a younger man in the 1650s in Oxford doing all different types of experiments on animals, working with Thomas Willis, who we call him the father of modern neurology because he actually is one of the first people to actually take a real interest in the brain. So Wren translates what he's seeing physiologically in the body. He was doing all these experiments to test William Harvey's, at that time, theory of circulation. Wren transfers that onto the city. So your second question was, there were like three parts to that question.
There were quite a number, but I think what I was curious about, does that association, the pivotal association between medicine and architecture, matter as much as you suggest it to in the book? I mean, that really, if Perrault hadn't basically said, guess what, I reject this, I reject this association, that maybe things would have settled a little bit differently.
That's a good question. Well, Perrault himself, right, he was a physician in Paris. He was also in the Academy of Sciences. And if Wren is well known for his work in London, Perrault, if you go to Paris and you see the colonnades on the Louvre, that's Perrault. Perrault also designed the observatory. If you're in the Luxembourg Gardens and you look straight up the gardens, there's a building way at the top, and that's the Paris Observatory. This is a 17th century building. Would blood transfusion have changed?
There was a serious change from theory to practice.
Right.
That's what I was getting from that moment, I don't know if the book quite actually illuminates that, and that's why I wanted to ask you about this, about how we got from such theory where, you know, almost a theory of everything at the time, or a theory of everything as they knew it back then, to eventually experimenting upon dogs and animal to human and so forth.
You see, I don't really see, maybe that's why we're you know, circling around on this together, is because I'm not really sure at that time that you could differentiate, nor I don't think you can really differentiate now, that there's a real distinction between theory and practice, right? Because so much of what they're doing, whether they're, as you're saying, torturing animals, which they were, or practicing science, all of that's built around changing theories about the body.
Sure.
Right? And Perrault himself is a traditionalist. I mean, he hates transfusion.
Yeah.
He hates transfusion because, unlike the English Protestants who are used to, I mean, in 17th century England, questioning everything was a sport. I mean, I think it was part of the national identity.
Yeah.
Unlike in France, where, you know, they had spent the better part of the 16th century fighting back anybody who would question anything, meaning the Protestants.
I mixed them up myself, you know.
The Protestant,
prostitute, missionary position, you know.
Where's my coffee?
All sorts of religion.
Where's my coffee?
You know, yes. Sex, religion, what's the difference?
So Perrault is a Catholic, and he doesn't believe in circulation at all.
Yeah.
It's disgusting in his mind. It's sacrilege, actually, because it goes against everything that he knows.
Yeah.
So he really wants his secret experiments that he does on behalf of Louis XIV in the French Academy of Sciences in the King's Library. He really wants to see them fail.
Yeah.
Because all he's been asked to do really is to test to see if the English were right. Well,
yes.
Nobody wants the English to be right, and especially if they're doing something gross like transfusion. And what makes him mad is he's not successful, but he's also mad that he's not successful because that means, well, first he can prove the English were liars, that he thinks they were not telling the truth about transfusions, but he also recognizes that he wasn't doing it the right way either. So at once he wants to fail, and the other side he doesn't want to fail, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. Maybe
I don't think we're letting the English a little too off the hook by suggesting that they were constant skeptics, because as we learn in the book, there was, of course, a lovely little royal censorship system. Mm-hmm. And poor Oldenburg, who, of course, is the secretary, the publicist of the Royal Society, regrettably lacking the resources to disguise the little philosophical messages and communications he's sending among his peers, learns one day that, he gets arrested, basically, the poor man. And so what's interesting about that is that even though they're skeptical, there seems to be a great prohibition on expression that might almost be comparable to the French. Do you think that the French mode versus the British mode in terms of what you could get away with and what was considered official science at the time, that how much did this factor into the ongoing, what we see later on, which is this fascinating cultural war between the French and the British, sort of like the medical equivalent to the space race.
Who is going to
come up with blood transfusion first, and there's all sorts of Machiavellian scheming, you know, and that sort of thing. How much of the national character contributed to this conflict?
Well, I think you hit on the head, actually, what's at stake and what's at issue in England, right, is that so much of that royal censorship is coming from Charles II's government, right? And now he was newly restored to the throne. Because we had the Commonwealth before that with Cromwell. So the English government has a huge stake in trying to clamp down in the sense not to stop it, because they're very much in favor of marking out a place for themselves in science as part of a nationalistic practice.
Yes.
I think space race is perfectly the way to describe this, right? Because the space race was all about national identity and how science plays into that national identity. But at the same time, they didn't want it to be just willy-nilly.
Yeah.
I mean, the monarchy really wanted to have a clear idea of what was going on. But I think the spying that was happening was mainly to check out, to make sure that who was going to be anti-royalist.
Yeah.
And Oldenburg was not. He was very much in support of the monarchy. But also to make sure that the precarious situation that England was in at the time, engaging in all different types of wars with France, with the Netherlands, Spain was in there too, they really needed to make sure that they could stave off any types of espionage issues. So that's what's happening with Oldenburg. Oldenburg is, I don't know how many languages that man spoke. He was German by birth. And here he is now, the secretary of the recently formed Royal Society. And if there were ever a man who would be on Twitter, it would be Oldenburg.
Yeah.
I mean, because he is basically the place where anybody who's anybody who wants their science to be made public and retweeted, and republished in the Philosophical Transactions, it's Oldenburg.
Yes.
The question of, I still see France as being much more of a clamped down society, because there was really not a lot of wiggle room for anybody who went against the grain, where William Harvey goes totally against the grain, and that's part of the national identity. I mean, the English are very proud that Harvey is their own.
But how much, both for France and England, was this almost a private affair? I mean, confined to the Royal Society or even the French Academy or any of the medical elite in Paris? I mean, it seems to me that, at least as you presented in the book, that it is relatively isolated, aside from some connections to good old Louis XIV, right?
Uh-huh.
Yes. In fact, actually, it may even be more connected, I think, in France. Is it safe to say that that was the case? Or?
So you're talking about the extent to which all of these activities,
people knew
about
them
outside
of... Yes, the sort of competition and the intelligence and things like that.
I think for a well-educated public, people were very aware of it. In fact, those philosophical transactions that Henry Oldenburg was publishing on behalf of the Royal Society, there were all these... As soon as they would come off the presses, there were hordes of people clamoring to get those early scientific newspapers and to pass them around, because it wasn't just, I mean, you can't think about these in terms of like really dry case reports in, I don't know, the British Medical Journal or JAMA or something. No, these told really cool stories about, you know, the Royal Society trying to figure out what the meaning of a monstrous birth was, right? It did that. It, was there really a man who reported that a cabbage that was grown with six heads?
Yeah.
Right? And they're looking at this trying to find some sort of scientific answer, but that just makes really good National Enquirer reading as well. And in France as well, people are just very interested in knowing about all of these things. So science was a public practice to such a degree that women of the salons of 17th century actually were like attending public dissections.
Yes.
Out in the king's gardens because they're just so interested. And then, you know, the microscope was newly invented and they're getting all these little samples of all different things, plants and semen and blood and all things to look under. I mean, these are elite women.
But that's extraordinary because we haven't even talked about the Molloy trial, the murder and all that, where, let's try to backtrack here and get Jean-Baptiste Denis into the conversation. Now, this guy is a remarkable scoundrel. He is a guy who is taking all this stuff from England and not giving them credit, and he's doing his own transfusion experiments. And he has quite a... You were actually a little apologetic towards him because you initially described...
I sort of like him, actually.
Yeah, but you describe him having a naive hubris when he is there essentially going ahead and getting his hands dirty, rolling up his sleeves, basically dissecting these cadavers and just showing medical students how to do so. And this is a remarkable ego, I think. And I'm not sure if it's so naive because later on, now he's trying to take credit for things he hasn't entirely participated. He's insisting that he was the first to be the blood transfusion. And then later on, we have in the case of Molloy, this poor guy, after the third attempt to transfuse, he is killed. And his wife...
I know, it's don't give away the story.
I think we can give... I mean, his wife actually, remarkably, gets accused of being contributed to causing the murder. Now, when you say that in French society there were elite women who were attending these dissections, and I look at the case of poor Molloy's wife, was it the class situation that caused
absolutely.
That distinction?
Absolutely. So I guess to back up on Denis, what we think about him, I have a fondness for him because he is not part of that French elite, right? Yeah. He's born to a family of artisans.
Yes.
And as is often the case still now, is you have to have something of a pedigree to get into the very, very top medical schools. And the Medical School of Paris is the elite place where all of the blue bloods, I just realized the pun in the context of my book, all the blue bloods would go. Yeah. And Denis actually ends up going to medical school against odds, and he shows up at Montpellier, which is in the southern part of France, which has a bit more Protestant leanings than the very hyper-traditional medical school of Paris. Now, that school itself is the rival medical school, and we know what we do with rivals.
Yes.
It was the school where dummies go. All they do is drink and convort around. Denis says, but I still want to be a Paris doctor because that's the best of the best.
Yes.
So he goes up to Paris, and he's trying really just to get his foot in the door and doors that are slammed shut to him.
Yeah.
Okay, now, do we like what he continued to do? Because he is pretty scheming. Yes. And I do think he picks blood transfusion as the one way to get his name on the radar because it's clear that the French find it distasteful. They don't, as I said, they don't even believe in circulation. And you have to believe in circulation to be able to get into blood transfusion. And I think he purposely picks blood transfusion because he knows he's going to, it's going to be a little bit like a 2-year-old child who throws a temper tantrum because they want your attention, right? Yeah. He's going to throw this scientific temper tantrum so that people will notice him. Now, you can't blame the guy, can you? I mean, what else would you want him to do? Is that,
there's a temperament to this guy. I mean, now granted, I give you this, old megalomaniacs are quite charming and they're quite interesting. And Denis certainly is in his own deranged way, in his own baleful way. But the thing about Denis is that here's a guy who seems to find absolute delight in the idea of a dog who is howling in pain. He can actually
deal with that if he knows that the end result of that is that the dog will be in perfect health?
Similar to what we were talking about earlier with the Royal Society. You just don't want to like any of these guys because of... I know those chapters on animal experiments are hard to read.
It is.
You know what, though? Then you could lump all of the rest of them as being in deranged. I think there's one story...
Not deranged. Let's say really cold-hearted. That you have to be cold-hearted to...
Okay, I'm not justifying their actions, but here's the question. There's a delicate calculus that they have to do is, okay, do we... And this does not say they delight in what they're doing. In fact, there's, the story of Hook, Robert Hook, who performs this horrific experiment in which he opens up a dog's trachea and then puts the bellows in it. And the dog is suffering horribly. And Hook, at a moment, says, "Whew, I can't do this anymore."
Yeah.
All right. And he doesn't for a while. But we find him not long after doing more experiments. Or Christopher Wren, who injected opium or some other, an emetic, I think, in the veins of a servant. Already there's class issues there.
Sure.
And the man swoons and almost dies. And Wren says, "I can't do this anymore." And he doesn't, for the largest part. And he actually moves to architecture, where you really can't hurt people.
Sure. At least not directly.
Well, I guess falling stones and things can give you problems. But, in the case of Hook, what's your choice? Is not do this and not discover truths about the natural world?
That's a good point.
Because there's a quest. There's this intense need to know that they really, we're in the midst of a scientific revolution. They want to know. And knowing things has always, from the very beginnings in mythology, there's always a huge price to pay. And it's a bit like opening Pandora's box.
This could very well just be the presentation in the book, because the sense I got was that these guys were muzzling the dogs down. And
otherwise, they'll bite you.
Well,
if you're
going to... Well, of course, they'll bite and they're howling out in pain. And is there any scholarship to indicate from the Denis camp that these guys were seriously remorseful about the prospect of dealing with animals who were just howling and braying in pain?
No.
Anything? You couldn't find anything to make any efforts to?
No, I think I did.
Yeah. I'm sure
not
you did.
A cold-blooded.
Yeah, I'm sure.
No, I mean, I think...
You said you were churned by him. I figured you could, anyway.
is that the cases where I did find that there was some sort of regret, remorse, the ones I just told you about Wren and Hook.
If
I was able to write those in such, sorry, horrific way. I love dogs. I really do.
Yeah,
and
I do too.
And I had it. I can tell. I mean, that's.
I'm a carnivore, and I have no problems. I'm pretty black humored, but those dog chapters, I gotta say,
it's funny. And when I wrote them, I had actually my dog right at my feet the entire time, and it's not some sort of journalistic hype. Is that essentially, in many ways, I was translating for a modern audience what the tenor, the tone, and the descriptions and details. Because I think what's unsettling about those moments is because they're so detailed.
Yeah.
I mean, we know how they're cutting it open. We know where they're slitting the veins and stuff. None of this is made up in this book. It's all nonfiction. So the only way that I could describe it was using those case reports. And do we see remorse? I think that we have to be able to see some remorse. If they were that able to talk about the cries and the screamings of the dogs, they noticed them.
I guess this is a tricky situation. I guess we don't really know if they were cold political scientists or people who really just didn't want to talk about it, like, soldiers coming back from the war, so to speak.
I wonder about that. I think, again, it's, trying to balance the need to know with the methods you have to use to know it.
Yeah.
And we have to be really careful, I think. There are reasons why we have institutional research boards.
Yes.
Right, and many of these types of episodes, whether the Nuremberg trials or Tuskegee, any number of the horrors that have been imposed on human beings and animals, to justify the need to know, we now have an ever-changing, and it needs to always be ever-changing, sense of what's ethical and what's not, and the need to consent.
But the castigation against the Meroy family reminded me very much of Tuskegee. Glad that you mentioned that up. I wanted to also, you know, since we seem to be talking about French versus British, and I think it's kind of an interesting rivalry for the sake of this, you bring up Arthur Koga, who is the 32-year-old guy who the Royal Society used. Now
he's an interesting character.
Here's the guy. He is both educated and eccentric. I mean, he's a guy who likes to speak Latin in every single social occasion. And he didn't make a single complaint throughout this experiment as he's getting the transfusion of sheep blood. Now, Koga came through John Wilkins, and this makes me wonder, is there anything to suggest that the Royal Society, perhaps through our man, our publicist Oldenburg, was looking for the ideal guy for their particular experiment, whereas it seems to me that Denis was like, you know what? Hey, here's a poor servant who will willfully take a small amount of money. We'll go ahead and just, you know, go ahead and take their blood, and they won't complain. I mean, what was the difference between Denis and Royal Society in terms of recruiting these?
You know, think about it, that Arthur Koga was recruited because they couldn't find a patient at Bedlam, right? The madhouse, asylum, and that's interesting to me. The conditions at Bedlam were horrific, absolutely horrific, and so the members of the Royal Society went out to Bedlam and asked the head of Bedlam, "Hey, do you have a patient we can use?" And the director says no. Now that's interesting. I spent a lot of time to figure out what the basis for that no was. And because really, you know, we know that one of the most vulnerable populations in medical experimentation has typically been incarcerated people,
the poor, the indigent, the mentally disabled. Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was interesting that the mental asylum director said no, but I can't be sure why. So who do they reach for? They reach for Koga, and yeah, he's well educated. Yeah, he spews Latin, but. There's some question about whether he is in the right place to be, in modern terms, to consent.
Yeah.
So is he in the right place then to explicitly say stop?
Yeah.
Right? So and Denis is also looking for that perfect patient who is so, I'm using my quote marks, deranged.
Yeah.
That they don't, there's not a chance that they're going to say no. I mean, they tie up Morois, who's running the streets naked in delusionary fits of screaming. They tie him up, and he never had a chance to consent. I mean, that's why we have IRB regulations is to make sure that those people would have rights. But we're at the beginning of the scientific revolution, long before our modern notions of morality and ethics have kicked in.
Yeah, but it seems to me that Denis was more mercenary-minded because he has his pivotal station in Parisian life to maintain, whereas the Royal Society seemed to be more along the lines of, well, we got to find the right guy, we've got to look at this a little bit more systematically. It almost seems like Denis was less careful or less nuanced than the Royal Society. And I'm curious if this really affected his choice of who he recruited for his transfusion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you think about it, Denis, so the first, it was the English blood circulation trials, infusion trials, and then canine to canine blood transfusion trials. And they were very close to doing the next logical step, which was to perform the procedure in humans. Denis knows that he's on borrowed time, and he's trying to scoop them. So he goes in and grabs a young boy, doesn't really grab, but he pays the mother of a young boy to infuse her son who's had fevers. The next one is a butcher, and the third one is this mentally ill man. And he's doing it all so that he can scoop the English.
Yeah.
And the English, once they get word, and Denis, you know, of course, screams with delight in every single, in the philosophical trans, well, he tries to get into the philosophical transactions. He publishes it far and wide, and he never says, I owe it to the English for the idea.
Yes.
And the English, Oldenburg gets in big trouble because the Royal Society said, you know what, you're not doing a very good job of PR here.
Yeah.
How is it this Frenchman doesn't know that we did this?
Yeah.
Even though that's improbable, Denis did know about it. And in the records, they say, we were really close, you know.
Yeah.
We were really close. It just, we're going to be a little, we had some, what did they say? Some questions of moral debate or something that we needed to work through. So that tells me that they're not all bloodthirsty, right? Either they just didn't get their act together in time to do it, or really they were trying to say, what do you think? But Denis didn't, you're right, he didn't have those moral reservations.
Yeah. Was morality one of the reasons why the Royal Society was to do a very smoother transfusion with Koga, do you think? That morality led to, I suppose, the beginnings of medical ethics?
Oh my gosh, no. If you think about the way that that transfusion was done, right? It was a sideshow, freak show,
yeah.
Right? My favorite part of the entire thing is Koga sitting in a chair. The fact, maybe it seems a little less inhumane because they don't have to tie him up screaming.
Yeah.
The way they did with the French guy. But, you know, Koga is, he says, so you're going to transfuse me with sheep's blood, eh?
Yeah.
Hand me that knife and let me taste that blood.
Yes.
It's so sweet. And there are people swarming, right? And
yeah.
They're sort of watching him. Is what's going to happen? Step right up, folks. And then, you know, they offer him some wormwood wine and a smoke. That doesn't feel like an ethical experiment to me, if we're going to put modern judgment on it.
Is this really fair to the experiments that were going on? Were they really that grisly, or have they always been that grisly and we just don't talk about this?
In the end, we always have to take a historical viewpoint on what we're doing, right? And yes, those experiments that I described were grisly. They were gross. They were hard to write. And what's funny is,
hard to read.
As I was writing them, I was in the something of a, I don't know, I was in the writer mode, right? Where I was, and sort of there was this critical distance that I was taking. It was almost a journalistic mode, you know, where you go in and you describe and you really try to keep your emotion out of it. But you try to paint it in a way so that your readers are fully in the scene. But when I read the book, I reread portions of those just last week. I went, oh my God. I mean, I was grossed out too.
You should read this before a crowd and then compete with Chuck Palahniuk, who allegedly has his crowd fainting. You know?
I have had a student pass out in one of my classes.
Oh, wow.
Okay. During the bloodletting thing. but I guess that for me, the point of the matter is that historically, we're going to look back at our own period. What will people say about us? Now, if you want to use terms like grisly and gruesome, there are some modern practices. And if you talk to some surgeons about what happens when people are, you know, out, you know, they're doing some massive, important, life-saving surgeries.
Yes.
But also think about chemotherapy. What are people going to say about us in 100 years? Well, maybe hopefully not in 100
years. What are they going to say about us in 10, 15 years?
Exactly.
You know, my sister, she's in medical school, and the first day or one of the first weeks, they said, everything you learn today will be totally different in about 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an astonishing occupation to know that, like, oh, wow. So what we're learning right now, which is completely cutting edge, which does the job, will be the equivalent of bloodletting in about, you know, 50 years for all we know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I think for me, the bigger take-home message on this book is not just about this very weird story that took place over a short period of time. I mean, the span of the book is only about 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, of course, there's the longer lead-in to sort of help understand how we got there. But the questions that I ask are the ways in which we can use this story to ask bigger questions is, okay, how far are we willing as a society to let our research go? All right? So blood transfusion was incredibly frightening for reasons we haven't talked about, but you know, when you're putting animal blood into human veins, you have to start wondering about what the effect on the human is going to be.
Especially when you don't know about blood types.
You don't know about blood types for another 250 years.
Yeah.
And there's debate, is Descartes right?
Yeah.
Are we sure the soul's not in the blood? And if we're not sure we fully agree with Descartes, what are we doing when we're putting animal blood into humans, right? And vice versa. But then again, we look at blood transfusion. If you talk to any doctor, they'll say they can't imagine practicing medicine without the benefits of blood transfusion.
Yeah.
But blood transfusion was so scary, and not just because of all the grisly experiments that were needing to go on, but it was so frightening to society that it needed to be banned for 150 years after this court case that you alluded to, where Denis was called up on murder charges, and then blame got passed off to the mentally ill man's widow. So how far will we let society go, and if so, at what price, right?
Yeah.
I have to wonder how many lives could have been saved. You know, the whole thing about blood types, it was such an easy experiment. Carl Landsteiner's discovery of blood types was basically just said, hey, lab assistant, can I have a little bit of your blood? Colleague over here, can I have another little bit of your blood? And he basically said, does this the blood of this person coagulate with this person? Yes. How about this person? That? No. And then he started to plot it out, and that's how he came up with, I think, the first three blood types, and then later other blood types were discovered. It was a very basic experiment that you didn't need to have, like, you know, genetic theory, immunology, and microbiology to figure out. Could they have gotten to that point? If so, how many lives would have been saved, and also how many lives would have been really painfully lost?
Yes.
During these things. So it makes us have to stop and wonder, as we're debating what our own societal limits will be on our science, not just how far are we willing to go, but rather as well how history is going to judge us.
Sure. Well, on that accusatory note, which manages to get in Descartes as well as the red-handed notion we've been talking about, Holly, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
It was great. Hey, thanks.